We were talking about the massive cuts to UNRWA. The World Food Program of the United Nations has also massive cuts.
Indeed, it's shocking. I was trying to talk just a few days ago to some old colleagues who work on these issues, and I find that they've been reassigned or they've lost their jobs. We only have one global emergency response system at the moment, and that is centered upon the World Food Programme. And so we need to make it work, because if it doesn't work, we're going to find ourselves facing the kinds of crises of mass mortality that we have simply not seen for half a century or longer.
Well, Alex Zavala, we thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the World Peace Foundation at Tufts University, author of the book Mass Starvation, The History and Future of Famine. We'll link to your pieces on Sudan and Gaza and more. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shruhavdo Kadus, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Demento. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. Only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO just finished our annual All Thrills, No Frills special programming campaign. We want to thank all of our supporters for helping us bring the community engaging, unique, and all-around fun special episodes and killer marathons. We wouldn't be able to do it without our listeners. And if you missed out on any of the programming, you can check out the list of specials at kboo.fm/thrills.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek takes steps to build an official government office for her wife, Amy. The number of higher ed institutions serving Hispanic Oregonians is on the rise. And in international news, the UN passes a ceasefire resolution in Gaza. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 25th, 2024. I'm Michelle Coppola. Amy Kotek Wilson, the wife of Oregon Governor Tina Kotek, will get a new state-funded advisor this week. This is part of the governor's plan to consider the establishment of an office of the first spouse. Some have speculated this is also related to the departure of three of the governor's top aides. Malia Masiba, a staffer with the Oregon Department of Administrative Services, joins the governor's office today. She is part of a temporary six-month rotation intended to help explore the establishment of the office of the first spouse. That position would also assist and support the current first spouse in her official capacity. Three major staffers are leaving the office soon: Kotek's Chief of Staff, Andrea Cooper, Deputy Chief of Staff, Lindsay O'Brien, and Special Advisor, Amy Tibbs, will all be gone, or at least on leave, by early April. This leadership vacuum comes at a bad time. In fact, the three women make up three of four senior aides Kotek's office lists as the executive team. The fourth member, Deputy Chief of Staff Chris Warner, will assume the role of Chief of Staff. OPB and Willamette Week report that the senior staff exodus was allegedly due to personality conflicts between the staff and Amy Kotek Wilson. The three apparently disagreed with the first spouse's level of involvement in the governor's office. A new report finds that 23 colleges and universities in Oregon have substantial Hispanic populations. Many are community college and private four-year institutions. KBOO reporter Birdie has the details.
The number of higher institutions serving Hispanic students in Oregon is increasing, according to a new report. Excellencia in Education researched Hispanic-serving institutions, which are defined as schools where students of Latino origin make up 25% or more of the population. Oregon has 5. The organization also measured emerging Hispanic-serving institutions, where Hispanic students make up 15 to 25% of the population. Oregon has 23, ranking 5th most and just below Texas. Deborah Santiago heads Excellencia in Education and saw a pattern to these students' enrollment.
That has implications as you look in state policy and recruitment efforts and others of where are your Latinx students going? Where are they choosing to enroll? And we see that they are very represented at the community college level in Oregon and at smaller but four-year private institutions.
California had the most emerging Hispanic-serving institutions in the country. Nationwide, there are 600 Hispanic-serving institutions, representing a fifth of all colleges and universities. Santiago notes many in Oregon are first-generation college students.
The awareness of college knowledge, financial aid, student support services, and others might not be as robust or clear to them as might be for other populations who are not first-generation college goers.
Santiago says her organization identifies where Hispanic students are enrolling and what that means for them.
Thinking about what are these institutions doing to ensure that every student that made a choice to enroll at that institution actually graduates and that the institution fulfills the social contract that's kind of implicit when a student enrolls that they want to meet their educational goals.
For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Birdie.
Some relief for small dairy farmers in the state as they were told that they do not have to apply for a permit that would have required them to install expensive drainage systems usually reserved for large-scale farms. This follows a lawsuit filed by small dairy farmers and the Oregon Department of Agriculture. The agency announced Thursday that it is withdrawing its decision to require small dairy farms to apply for this permit. Last year, dairy industry lobbyists got the department to reinterpret its definition of a confined animal feeding operation, or CAFO. They complained that small dairy farms had an unfair advantage over big dairy farms due to CAFO regulations. The rules would have required small dairy farms to install expensive drainage systems, even if they only have a handful of cows, sheep, or goats. CAFO regulations are necessary for large farms that produce tons of manure and have a much bigger impact on the environment. The small dairy farmers filing the lawsuit argue that their animals spend most of their lives outside and their businesses largely serve their local communities. The lawsuit stopped the regulations from kicking in, but the decision's withdrawal is only temporary, and the lawsuit will continue in federal court. Washington state lawmakers have passed legislation that provides greater protections against predatory loans. Tech companies that offer financial services were exploiting a loophole to charge people excessive interest rates. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Lawmakers in Olympia this session moved to add more protections for consumers against predatory loans. Washington state lawmakers passed Senate Bill 6025 unanimously in both chambers, closing a loophole companies were using to evade caps on the amount of interest that can be charged on loans. Sam Leonard is an attorney in Seattle and says tech companies that provide financial services, such as loans, would charter out-of-state banks, especially in Utah, where lenders can charge unlimited interest rates.
These fintech lenders a lot of times will charge 150, 200% interest on relatively small dollar loans, $3,000, $5,000, and the like.
Washington State has a set of protections called the Consumer Loan Act to shield people from predatory loans. Leonard says capping interest rates at the federal level would help people across the country. However, he says this bill goes a long way to increase protections for Washingtonians.
Not a lot of states at this time have passed similar legislation. And so Washington is out in front of the curve with regard to protecting low-income Washingtonians or other Washingtonians that might enter into these predatory loan products.
Leonard says the issue with predatory loans is that they keep people in continuous debt cycles.
Loan products like these essentially strip low-income individuals' ability to improve their economic situation.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon State and Washington State universities will be receiving more than $65 million from exiting Pac-12 schools. This according to a legal settlement shared with Sportico. The Pac-12 lost 10 of its members last year during a massive realignment of sports conferences nationwide. This left Oregon State and Washington State as the two sole members of the conference heading into the 2024-25 season. The shakeup left questions looming about where outstanding and future league revenue would go, as well as who would govern league decisions. According to the settlement, the outgoing schools will each receive $5 million from revenue distributions for this year back to the conference. They will also pay an additional $1.5 million each to bring the total to $65 million. OSU and Wazoo will likely receive more than these explicit payouts. The two remaining schools will keep the majority of future Pac-12 revenue as well. Only future income that was supposed to be paid to the outgoing schools before they leave in the summer is exempted. One significant part of future revenue will be money generated from the Pac-12's success in the men's March Madness tournament. The NCAA pays schools the rough equivalent of $2 million each for each game that they play in the tournament. Because the NCAA pays out every 6 years, OSU and Wazoo will receive the rewards for recent Pac-12 successes. By the way, the NCAA still does not compensate women's teams for their success in March Madness. The number 3-seeded Oregon State women's team faces off against Notre Dame on Friday in the Sweet 16. Working-class Americans are underrepresented in state legislatures. The hard right threatens to remove Speaker Johnson. And Washington, D.C.'s law allowing non-citizens to vote in local elections survives another legal challenge. With more on those stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There's this real sense that government and elected officials are really out of touch with the population. And one of the reasons for that is because our elected officials don't really come from the same set of backgrounds that most Americans come from.
Loyola political science professor Eric Hansen says surveys find less than 2% of state legislators previously held working class jobs, confirming the gap between the labor force and public servants. Alaska led the nation with 5%, but at least 10 states had none. Congress passed a $1 trillion spending package and avoided a government shutdown. President Joe Biden's signature capped a budget process extended by 6 months and requiring 4 stopgaps. But more than half of House Republicans voted no. Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to remove Speaker Mike Johnson for working with Democrats to pass it.
This is basically a warning, and it's time for us to go through the process, take our time, and find a new Speaker of the House that will stand with Republicans and our Republican majority.
Meanwhile, Wisconsin Republican Mike Gallagher says he'll retire in less than a month rather than serve out his term. That'll leave Johnson with a one-vote margin. Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski tells CNN she hasn't ruled out leaving the GOP or registering as an independent over the party's presidential nominee.
I wish that as Republicans, we had a nominee that I could get behind. I certainly can't get behind Donald Trump.
Murkowski is one of 7 Republicans who voted to convict former President Donald Trump in his second impeachment trial. After losing the primary in 2010, she won re-election as a write-in, the first senator to do that in 50 years. Trump has to pay a $500 million civil fraud bond today or face seizure of his assets. Former RNC chair Ronna McDaniel says, in spite of a promise from Trump, the party is funneling money from donors to a group paying his legal fees.
If they feel strongly to support his legal bills, then they have every right to do so. And I think he's being very open that they're helping with his legal bill.
NBC News has hired McDaniel as a political analyst, sparking criticism by some at the network who doubt her devotion to the truth. A federal judge has dismissed a challenge to a Washington, D.C. law that lets non-citizens vote in local elections. Washington Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton points to a sore point locally, the district's ability to run its own affairs.
D.C. residents, a majority of whom are black and brown, are worthy and capable of governing themselves.
D.C. lets non-citizens over 18 run for local office and vote in local elections after they've lived in the district for a month. A right-wing legal group sued after repeated attempts to overturn the law in Congress. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
As you may have heard earlier on Democracy Now!, the United Nations Security Council has finally passed a measure demanding ceasefire in Gaza. The measure passed on a 14-0 vote with the United States abstaining. The chamber broke into loud applause after that vote. The ceasefire resolution demands that a ceasefire through the month of Ramadan, which ends in April. The resolution also called on Hamas to release the 130 hostages it still holds in captivity, but did not make it a condition of the ceasefire. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken argued that the proposal did not include, quote, key language we view as essential, notably a condemnation of Hamas. For this reason, the U.S. abstained. Nonetheless, the U.S.'s decision not to veto the resolution marks a significant shift in its foreign policy. The United States had previously vetoed three ceasefire resolutions in the Council. On Friday, the United States failed to pass its own resolution supporting but not demanding, quote, an immediate and sustained ceasefire. UN experts warn that Gaza faces a, quote, imminent famine due to Israel's imposed embargo, humanitarian aid, and commercial goods. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Pearl Stark, the host and producer of The Point Puzzle, a two-minute weekly radio puzzle produced at KPOV Bend. KBOO News will feature The Point Puzzle in the coming weeks. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Your weather forecast for tonight will be cloudy with a low of 44. Tomorrow will be overcast and showery as well with a high of 56. Today in history, in 1911 in New York City, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire kills 146 garment workers. Our quote of the day is from American writer and second wave feminist leader Gloria Steinem, born this day in 1934. She said, quote, "This is no simple reform. It really is a revolution. Sex and race, because they are easy, visible differences, have been the primary ways of organizing human beings into superior and inferior groups and into the cheap labor on which this system still depends. We are talking about a society in which there will be no roles other than those chosen or those earned. We are really talking about humanism." The Not Invisible Act Commission's report on missing and murdered Indigenous people has received a written response from two federal agencies, the Justice Department and the Interior Department. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Two federal agencies published their response to a 2023 national report on missing and murdered Indigenous people. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman reports on what's next.
In 2020, Congress passed the Not Invisible Act. The bill created a commission to develop recommendations on how to best address the MMIP crisis. After conducting listening sessions across the country, they published their final report to the feds. The Department of Justice and Department of the Interior have just responded to it.
The biggest takeaway I have is just the fact that a lot of our resources are not streamlined. It's like a scattershot.
That's enrolled Northern Arapaho tribal member Jordan Dresser. He was part of the Not Invisible Act Commission, and he agrees with the report's takeaway that more coordination between the different agencies is crucial.
When a family's going through something like that, I think they sometimes don't know where to turn to.
The more than 200-page response from the two federal agencies outlines their commitment to continuing to work with tribal communities to find solutions to the crisis. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Now that the North American Indigenous Games Council has approved Arctic sports on a trial basis for its 2027 Games in Calgary, fans of Native Youth Olympics hope the Games can spread beyond Northern tribes. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, a team of athletes from Juneau, Alaska, visited schools in Kansas and New Mexico.
In Arctic sports, team members encourage each other to strive for their personal best. So it's not unusual for athletes to cheer on their opponents. In that spirit, Kyle Worrell, the head of the Native Youth Olympics program for Juno Schools, took a team of 6 athletes on tour.
Every school and community we've gone to, they've been very engaged.
The team demonstrated 7 games: the 1-foot and 2-foot high kick, the Alaskan high kick, scissor broad jump, seal hop, and the Inuit and Dene stick pulls, which today are part of friendly competitions that require strength, agility, and endurance, necessary for traditional hunters to hop over ice floes or carry heavy loads for long distances. Worrell says everywhere they went, students showed interest in the games and their history.
This sport really resonates with Indigenous people. It's about community, and I think all tribes know that community is really important.
Worrell is hopeful the sport can take root at the Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas, which has 2 Alaskan athletes who can help with the coaching. The team also traveled to the nearby Kickapoo Nation School to plant some seeds among kids who are not yet in college. Worrell says the Juno athletes gave them a chance to try out the games for themselves, which they seem to enjoy.
To be able to be in a space where your Indigenous identity is represented and honored, and you feel a sense of belonging.
The Juno team also traveled to New Mexico to visit the Santa Clara Pueblo Tribal School, the Santa Fe Indian School, and the Institute of American Indian Art. They left behind kits with equipment that included a kickstand, a hand-sewn sealskin ball, and 2 types of sticks. Worrell says the Calgary Games are 4 years out, plenty of time to train for NYO Games. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
New Mexico's congressional delegation announced last week $10 million for multipurpose facilities for 7 tribes in the state. The funding is under the U.S. Department of the Treasury's Capital Projects Fund to invest in New Mexico's Tribal Library Broadband Ready Facility Improvement Program. The program will construct a new child care center and expand 6 libraries and family resource centers to boost services and also provide broadband and computers. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
If you are a college student on financial aid, or maybe you know one, you'll want to listen up. Students across the country seeking college funding are encountering delays as they navigate the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, process. The FAFSA is normally available in October, but this year's FAFSA rollout in January has posed significant challenges for all students, especially those from mixed status families. Morley Keller, Senior Director for Strategic Programming at the National College Attainment Network, outlines the hurdles faced by students and families.
One of the first hurdles was at the FSAID account level. The second hurdle was when the FAFSA opened at the beginning of January, it was unable to accept anyone who did not have a Social Security number. They could not enter the FAFSA, like if a dependent student invited them as parent.
The Department of Education announced it has rolled out a fix for these issues, and parents can now enter information manually as opposed to it being filled in from the IRS. Federal officials also announced that some students could expect more delays after finding that a new error sent incorrect financial need information, known as Institutional Student Information Records, or ISIRs, to colleges. This resulted in colleges receiving inaccurate data. Keller says deadline adjustments are expected, but financial aid offers are not likely to reach students until mid to late April. Despite the troubles, she encourages students not to give up.
I just want to reiterate the point of, we just don't want people to give up on the process. There's a fix now. They're going to continue to improve the fixes on the FAFSA, and we want people to get their FAFSAs completed so that they can have a path to any type of post-secondary opportunity that they want next year.
For the most recent ISIR, officials with the U.S. Department of Education say it has resolved the issue for all ISIRs delivered on and after last Thursday, the 21st. For others, they have provided resources to colleges and universities. Keller adds that more information and updates can be found on the department's website for federal student aid. A new report by Open Secrets finds that dark money and hidden shell company funding is more involved than ever in the upcoming election, and more so than in previous campaigns. KBOO's Matea Carlin has more.
Undisclosed funding, or dark money, is pumping into the 2024 election cycle. Political spending, by donors who stay hidden, is reaching record heights, according to a report by Open Secrets. Author Anna Masulia says dark money might be coming from shadowy shell companies or nonprofits, and funds misleading attack ads against candidates from either party.
When you have dark money groups fueling this spending, the voter may not know what interest the secret donors behind that have in getting a specific candidate elected, a ballot measure passed, or any other policy issue.
In 2022, Open Secrets found that Conservative Americans PAC spent more than $2.4 million in GOP primary races for U.S. House seats in Missouri, Tennessee, and Arizona. They discovered the super PAC was bankrolled by the undisclosed American Economic Freedom Alliance and American Prosperity Alliance prior to the vote. It really varies from one state to the next in terms of which party and which side of the aisle is benefiting more. Also, the patchwork of disclosure and rules across the states vary greatly.
In some states, you can actually have 501c4 dark money groups or shell companies contribute directly to candidates' campaigns, which is something that's not allowed at the federal level. They're only allowed to spend in support of the candidate.
Masulia emphasizes that while dark money can come from various sources, it often comes from one type. She says, 501c4 nonprofits are supposed to exist for social welfare purposes, but due to few restrictions on their spending, they are able to spend practically unlimited sums on elections without ever disclosing their donors. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Matea Carlin.
For young people and parents in crisis, there's a new resource in the National Parent and Youth Helpline. There's a new bill in Congress that will expand support for the helpline, making its funding permanent. Suzanne Potter has that story.
The new National Parent and Youth Helpline has already taken 6,700 calls, texts, and live chats since its inception in January, and now the U.S. House of Representatives is considering a bill to fund it permanently. California Congresswoman Norma Torres introduced the bill on Friday. Dr. Lisa Payan Berlin is CEO of Parents Anonymous, which sponsored the bill and runs the helpline.
They build what we call protective factors. So that's resilience, social support, that's helping people deal with their underlying emotional issues, addresses substance abuse, domestic violence, and helps children flourish.
The nation's more than 174 million parents and youths up to age 25 can call or text the helpline at 855-427-2736 to reach a trained counselor for help with emotional issues. People can also join the live chat on the website nationalparentyouthhelpline.org 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Payan Berlin says the goal is to offer online, weekly, evidence-based emotional support groups to those in need around the country.
We have calls about gun violence. We have calls about suicide. We have calls about stress. We have calls about kids' learning challenges. We have kids who feel lonely and depressed. We know youth suicide is up 20%.
The bill would allocate $20 million a year to the program. So far, it has attracted endorsements from the nonprofits Parents Anonymous, 0-3, and the Child Welfare League of America. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 25th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Matea Carlin, Reed Johnson, David Rosenberg, Lisa Loving, and Birdie. This producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Terry D., Antonio Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Suzanne Potter. The director of Evening News is the elegant Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our cable programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, we cannot do it without you. So go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, where we'll be speaking with Pearl Stark. She is the host and producer of The Point Puzzle. Have a great night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
To who do you do the thing to do when it's time to do it, no matter to who? But there's nobody there to do it but you. And what is it that has to be done is a puzzling song.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I am speaking with Pearl Stark, the host and producer of The Point Puzzle, a 2-minute weekly radio puzzle produced at KPOV Bend. Welcome to the show, Pearl.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for coming on to talk with us. So for our listeners who aren't yet familiar, what is The Point Puzzle?
It is a 2-minute segment where I ask a puzzle every week, and then I give the answer to last week's and announce who the winner was. It's kind of a variety of logic, math, and word puzzles, but don't worry, it's mostly word puzzles.
How did you get started producing The Point Puzzle?
Well, I love radio, especially nonprofit and local community radio, and I also love puzzles, so it's kind of a natural fit. I'm here at KPOV in Bend, and when we started about 11 years ago, we started a daily morning news show, and we were trying to put together a variety of different segments that would air on it. I suggested a puzzle.
And so what is your process like for developing each week's puzzle?
Well, generally, I